So this is testing the waters, part two. Elu Naris, Perek Shlishi. So let's just go over some of the basics. There are three stages halachically in a woman's life. One is called Ktanu or Katnus. The second is Nara or Narus. And the third is Bagrus Bogeris. So how does a woman go from one stage to the other? So Katnus will end at the age of 12. And then she becomes a Nara. However, there are two qualifications that we have to insist upon. Number one is that she has to have what's called Shtei Saros. She has to have two pubic hairs. And number two, you have to add one day. So it means she's one day into her 13th year. She's 12 years plus one day. At that point, she becomes a Nara for 6 months. And then, when she's 12 and a half, she becomes a Bogeris. Now, the laws of a Nara are that middle stage, that half a year, are relevant to the following three areas of halacha. Number one, kinyanim, meaning if she finds something or somebody gives her a gift, who actually owns it? Is it hers or her father's? Well, let's say she gets employed and she has wages, a received payment. Does that accrue to her father? And that's based on a pasuk. The pasuk says, "Binureha base aviha," that as long as she's a Nara, she still remains in her father's possession, which means that all her monetary gains accrue to her father as long as she's a Nara. If she's a Ketana, she cannot acquire anything because a Ketana is a lav bar das. It's Ketana is a minor. So that's not even in the discussion. But once she becomes a Nara, then for all intents and purposes, she has the status of a bar das. She can effectuate kinyonim. But anything she owns is owned by the father. That's halacha number one of a Nara. That ceases, that terminates when she becomes a Bogeres. And then, if she acquires any possessions once she's a Bogeres, then she owns it herself. So it's interesting that in a halachic sense, a girl who's 12 and a half years old, if all things are equal, she owns all her possessions. She can enter into the marketplace and effectuate kinyonim, transactions, and everything is hers. So that's the first din of a Nara, binureha beis aviha. The second halacha of a Nara, and there's almost half of a Masechta dedicated to this halacha, that's called Masechta Nedarim, is that as long as she's a Nara, her father will be in control of her Nedarim. So if she takes a vow, her father could be Mefir, he can negate the vow and make it void, or he can accept the vow. That's called Kium HaNeder. So the vow and the neder now is dependent upon the father. That's again part of this binureha beis aviha. Once she's a bogeris, if she takes a neder, that neder is automatically binding. The third halacha of a Nara, which is the one that we're going to study today, is about what's called knas. Now, if you remember yesterday, we tried to use this pen. It didn't work very well. And we tried to write the word knas on the board. And all his reason in the class ran out to the store to buy us a... So I don't need five of them. You can give me just one black marker. But if we don't have one, then you'll have to write the word knas on your page. And a knas kufnam nun samach, which you'll see on the top line of our Mishnah, means a punitive monetary payment. Okay. Now this punitive monetary payment that we're about to discuss divides up into two parts. One part is called ma'anes, and the other is called mefateh. And the Torah differentiates between the two. Although the amount of money is the same, but nevertheless, there is an important difference. So let's talk about ma'anes. Ma'anes means a man who, against the will of this Nara, has a relationship with her. We call it in English a rape relationship. He violates her. That's called Nara. However, the parsha of Nara is conditional on the fact that she's a Nara Besula. She's never had a relationship before. So if a man violates a girl who's 12 years old, under the conditions that we mentioned earlier, and she's a Besula, and in such a case, the Torah imposes upon him two different halachas. One halacha is a monetary penalty, and he's got to pay chamishim kesef. And number two, the other halacha is a marriage halacha, that if she wants to marry him, he has to marry her, whether he likes it or not, and will force him to marry her. V'lo yuchal l'shalcha kol yomav. He's not allowed to divorce her. Again, what happens if he gives her a divorce, b'di'evet, that's a different issue. Then we get to the case of mefata. Mefata means that she agreed, she consented to have this relationship. In such a case, although he does have to pay a penalty, nevertheless, he doesn't have to marry her. Because since she consented, therefore the halacha of forcing him to marry her does not apply. Let's start the Mishnah. Elu naros sheyesh lahem knas. The Mishnah is going to delineate cases where both in mafata and ma'anes you pay a knas. There's going to be a long discussion here, which we'll get to later, as to whether or not this Mishnah might even refer to a mafata. I told you that it refers to both a ma'anes and a mafata. That's not necessarily so, but for our purposes, until we see how we're going to disprove that thesis, that is the assumption that we're operating with. So we're talking about either a ma'ane situation or a mafata situation. She's a nara besula, and yesh lahem knas. So let's take a look at Rashi. Elu naros. Dafka nara mishehevia shte saros ad sheti boger vehem shisha chadoshim shebein narus lebagus. So Rashi says we're talking about a nara, and only a nara. Who is a nara? She has shte saros, she's already 12 years old, and until she becomes a bogeres ad sheti boger, which means until 6 months pass, which those are the 6 months between narus and bagus, avoktana ubogeres ein lahem knas. However, if she's too young, I mean she's less than 12 years old, she's a ketana. Or if she's too old, she's a bogeres, she's past 12 and a half, then there is no knas. And Rashi's premise is going to be threshed out in the sugi itself. Rashi's already giving us a little bit of a preview of coming attractions. She yeshlem knas. Rashi says im onsa. So Rashi limits this Mishnah to the case of onus. And as I indicated to you before, we're going to assume the Mishnah applies even to a mafata, but Rashi is based on a proof that will come up soon that we cannot be talking about a case of mafata. So if you're writing notes, just make yourself an indication, a notification, you know, to remind a reminder that we have to prove that this Mishnah could not be talking about a mafata situation. Therefore, Rashi singles out onus. And Rashi says, no sein lo avia chamishim kesef. Now, Rabosa, we go back to the first halacha in Nara. Remember, the first halacha in Nara is that all monetary possessions that she owns go accrue to the father, benurei beis avia. The 50 kesef, which is a penalty for the onus, likewise, goes to the father. Kidichsiv. Okay, so here we need a chumash. If somebody could, Jerry, do you mind opening this up to Dvarim Perik Chavbeis Parshas Kiteitze? And there it says Vinasan ha'isha shochev ima. And I think the next part of the pasuk says La'via nara, Mitch, right? Yeah, you don't have to look it up, Mitch, but we have to look it up. Oh, you have it in front of you. Okay, so Rashi only quotes part of the pasuk, but the next part of the pasuk says La'via nara. And then it should say Chamishim Kesef. Am I correct?
Yes.
Now, the Mishnah is going to list what we call psulos. So again, if I had a simple marker, which I don't have, I would write on the board psulos on one side and ksheros on the other side. Let's explain. Ksheros means a woman that he could marry. So he rapes a woman that he could have married. There's no reason he couldn't have married her. That's called ksheros. Psulos is a woman that he would be enjoined from marrying. He couldn't marry her for whatever reason. For example, the first reason that we're going to have is haba al mamzeres, that her status is that of a mamzeres. We'll talk about what a mamzer or mamzeres is in just a second. But Rashi is quick to the draw here. And he says, what are you telling me? Elu naras sheyeshlem knas. These are the women that receive a knas, only psulos, like a mamzeres, and we'll get to a whole list of psulos. The Gemara Parak, you'll see this on line 5 in Rashi, aval ksheros lo, that's a rhetorical question. Umeshani, the Gemara answers, psulos itzrich le lashma inon. The Gemara is going to tell us that our Mishnah wants to tell us a chidush. It was upgraded, it was without a shadow of a doubt that in the case of a kshero, where the Torah says he has to marry her because he's allowed to marry her, the Torah says he has to pay this penalty. So obviously the Torah is talking about a kshero. The chiddush of our Mishnah, going even a step further, without even mentioning the simple statement, is that even in the case of a psula, where we cannot force him to marry her as we normally do in a case of ma'anes, nevertheless he still has to pay. He starts to pay the parsha. I mean, the parsha of paying the 50 kes. So, Rabbi, let me ask you the following question. The parsha has two parts to it. One part is a monetary penalty, and the other part, in the case of manis, is that he has to marry her. Lo siyalu ishal yuchal shal. Is it one interdependent parsha, or are they two independent parshios? Excellent. Two independent parashiyos. And then Afkamina is going to be the case of psulos. As far as the halacha of Velosi Elisha that he has to marry her, we're going to have to suspend that halacha because she's psula. She's a mamzeres, for example. But nevertheless, the parsha of Chamishim Kesef is independent. It stands on its own 2 feet. And he has to pay that penalty regardless, despite the fact that he's not going to marry her. So the two different dimensions of the parsha of Ma'anes, and they're not interdependent, but rather independent. Clear? Alright. Who is or what is a mamzer or mamzeres? Can anybody answer that question?
Eshesish.
No. Eshesish is certainly one of them. What else? Excellent. That's called an erva. Again, a word that you have to know if we decide to learn this parak. Erva, ayin, vav. No, ayin, resh, vav, hey. Erva. Which means that there's a chiyuv kares in that relationship. The nature of the anti-gravitational force, in other words, the pushing one from the other, the isa, the barrier that separates them, is an isa kares. If they would have a relationship, the punishment for that would be an isa kares. We'll see that there's one exception in just a second. But in any event, if a man has a relationship with a woman and violates that isa kares, the child from that marriage will be a mamzer. A mamzer is only allowed to marry two categories. Number one, a mamzeres, and number two, a gioris, yeah. Right? Only a mamzeres or a gioris. Now, let's assume that the ma'anes is a kosher, meaning he's not such a kosher guy, if you know what I mean, but he's not what we call psule yuchsin, he's not disqualified from marrying a Jewish girl because he's not a mamzer. He cannot marry this girl that he raped because she's a mamzeres. Nevertheless, the Mishnah says she still has rights to the knas. Again, the knas goes to the father, and he will pay chamishim kesef. So that's the case of mamzeres. Now we get to the more complicated cases, and they are the cases of nesina and kusis. Now let me just say something at the outset, which I hope will pedagogically will make things a little bit easier for us. There is a very striking resemblance or commonality, if we could say, between Nesina and Kusis. And then they're different categories, but they're very similar. Why? What's common in both cases? These are non-Jews who converted to Judaism, but for the wrong reason. They were not motivated to join the Jewish people because they love Judaism and they really want to be Jewish, but rather for an ulterior motive. And that motive is to save their own skin. So in very rare cases in Jewish history, the goyim were actually afraid of the Jews. That's kind of rare, but in any event, so there were two periods of time. We're going to go through them. One is during the period of Yoshua, and the other is later on during the period of David HaMelech. And in these two periods of time, the Jews were very powerful. They were a military force to be, you know, to be reckoned with on a very serious level. So let's take first the case of what's called an Nesina. Now, the word Nesina, which describes in this case it's in feminine, in masculine it would be a Nasin, so we add the hey for feminine. The word Nasin comes from Vinasan, or Vayitnem. So it's very interesting. The word Vayitnem is really a secondary part of the entire story of the Nesinim. But that word, Vayitnem, was the word that they borrowed to give a name to this whole group of people. Now, who was this group of people? So if you take a look at Rashi, Divrei HaMaskil Nesina, which is about seven lines down from the top, Rashi identifies the Nesinim as Givonim. Okay? Now, what happens is that Yoshua enters the land and he conquers two major fortified cities. One is Jericho, and the other is Ai. And as a result of these two successful victorious battles, the fear of the Lord, the fear of the Jewish people, is in the hearts of the people. In other words, the Canaanites are overwhelmed by fear because they think that Yoshua is going to decimate the entire land. So there's a group of people that came from an area called Givon. They were called the Givonim. And they decided, we're going to trick Yoshua in order to save our skin. And we're going to present ourselves as if we want to convert to Judaism, when in truth they had no interest in Judaism, only to save their own skin. Later on in history, they became a thorn in the side of the Jewish people. They were very cruel. And their midos indicated that they weren't really part of the Bnei Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. They did not have the moral, ethical Jewish code, genetic Jewish code. Now what happened is that somehow they dressed up in a certain way and they actually fooled Yoshua. They pulled the wool over his eyes and he thought they were sincere. He thought they came from a far off country. And he decided to accept them as converts. And they entered into a bris, a pact. And in the context of this pact, the Zkenim, the elders of Israel, took a shvua, they took an oath to not to harm these Givonim. Later on in history, when they realized that they were duped, the Zkenim and Yoshua at the helm were duped, they really wanted to invalidate that bris, that covenant, and that shvua, that oath. But they didn't do so, probably because of Chil Hashem. So they, you know, you really have to know a lot about Chil Hashem. Chil Hashem is a sugya, you know, to understand, you know, do we accept people who really have to be destroyed because of Chil Hashem? You know, that, you know, anyone who might remember the names Sabra Vishatila, if any, you know, things like that. You know, there are people who really maybe deserve to die, but we have to, you know, we have to worry about Chil Hashem. And so at that time, I don't know, I'm not taking a political stand on this, but I'm just saying there were those those who claim that, you know, Jewish ethics requires a higher level, and the Goyim judge us by this higher level, and therefore when we destroy, we didn't actually destroy the Palestinians there. We only allowed, you know, the Christians to be they were completely decimated there, but we could have prevented it. So in any event, there's something called Chil Hashem. So because of this solemn oath that these Canaan had taken to the to protect the Givonim, or at least not attack the Givonim, therefore, even when they found out later that they were duped, they respected that oath, and basically the Givonim were sort of like a fifth column. They were part of Klal Yisrael, but they weren't really part of Klal Yisrael, because their Geirus was really unacceptable. They were not Geiri Emes. They were not true Geirim. Now, fast forward a few generations to the time of David HaMelech. At the time of David HaMelech, that's when the Givonim really, really expressed cruelty against Klal Yisrael. You know, they performed acts of cruelty, giving the Jewish people something that would cause them terrible anguish and so forth and so on. At that point, David HaMelech instituted a gzera, and that gzera was that the Givonim should be slaves. They should serve as avodim. You know, they no longer have the status of Jews, but they have the status of avodim. And that's a sugya Masechta Yevamos, which Rashi quotes over here. Now, why are they called Nesinim? As I told you, that the name Nesinim is a very strange name. Al Shem, because of the pasuk that says Vayitnem Yoshua Chotvei Eitzim V'Shoavei Mayim. Vayitnem, you see that word Vayitnem. So again, this process of designating the Givonim as servants to Klal Yisrael already began at the time of Yeshua, and Yeshua realized that he was duped, and they became Chotvei Eitzim V'Shoavei Mayim. They would chop the wood, and they would carry the waters. And it says Vayitnem. Vayitnem means he designated them. So that word designation, which is Vayitnem, hence the name Nesinim. They were called Nesinim. So again, the major point that we want to know here is that the Geirus was not a sincere Geirus. Now this, my friends, raises the whole question about Geirus. You know, what is the status of someone who joins the Jewish people and the Jewish faith for ulterior reasons? You know, we know that Rus HaMoaviah, she was the paradigm of a Ger Emes, right? A Gioris, that she was motivated because she wanted to join the Jewish people. But throughout Jewish history, we've had cases, and even today in contemporary life, of people who join the Jewish people for physical protection or for marriage reasons, for other, you know, ulterior motives, and the question is whether the halacha will recognize their geirus or not. So it seems that with regard to Nesinim, it would seem that their geirus was not a valid geirus, and therefore they had the status of avod. Now, if you take a look at Tosus, Dibra Maskel Elu, it's a gigantic Tosus about the Nesinim and their status. So if you look at the third of the wide lines, you see where he says, V'nira l'Rabbeinu Tam? I'm skipping Rashi for the moment, just to show you this Rabbeinu Tam. Because Rashi, as you know, says, David Gazar Aleihem, that David instituted Gzera, making them into Avadim. And Tosus wants to assume that according to Rashi, if not for the Gzera of David, it would seem that they could marry into the Jewish people, that their Gerus, their conversion, was valid. Rabbeinu Tam rejects his grandfather's position, and he says, Nesina Asura Midoraisa, even without the Gzera of David, a Jewish person is not allowed to marry a Nesina. And why is that? Mishum lo tischatein bam. The Torah says that you cannot marry a member of the seven nations that occupy the land of Israel. Those Shiva Amamin have to be destroyed, and they cannot marry into the Jewish faith. So therefore, how could Rashi indicate that the reason why you can't marry an Asina is because David HaMelech instituted a Gzera to give them the status of Avadim, and you cannot marry an Eved or a Shivcha? Even without that, says Rabbeinu Tam, there would be a Doraisa prohibition against marrying a Asina. And the reason for that is because a Nesina comes under one of the Sheva Amamim about which the Torah says Lo Tischatein Bam. Now some say that according to Rashi, although the Torah made a lav of Lo Tischatein Bam, that only applies to the first generation. But when there's Gerus and then there's a second generation, so the second generation is allowed to marry into the Jewish people. Now already by the time of David HaMelech, this was a second generation. So if we recognize the Gerus, then the Isur of Lo Tischatein Bam is lifted because we're talking about a second generation. And the proof to support Rashi's position is the fact that in the case of Mitzri and Adomi, the Torah says how many generations they're not allowed to come into the fold. So if you have, for example, a Mitzri who becomes a Ger, he's not allowed to enter into the fold. He can't marry a Jewish girl. Nor could his children or his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, could marry into the fold. That's Doravi. But the Torah doesn't say anything about the Shiva Amamin, implying that when the Torah says don't marry them, even if they convert, that's only the first generation. But already the second generation could enter into the Jewish fold. Hence the point to Rashi. When it comes to David HaMelech's generation, by that time, the Nesinim were already... we're already second generation, etc., Nesinim, after the conversion of their parents or grandparents. And therefore they could, on a Doraisa level, enter into the faith. They could marry a Jewish woman. But David HaMelech made a gzera, and he says we have to stay away from them. They have very cruel midos, and therefore he made them into Avadim, etc. So just keep in mind that there's a machlokus between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam about the Doraisa status of Nesina, whereas Rashi would hold that a Nesina could marry a Jewish man on a Doraisa level, if not for the Gzeir of David. Rabbeinu Tam holds that Nesina comes under the Isur of Lo Tischatein Bam, insofar as it's the seven nations, and that's an Isur Doraisa. The only thing that David added here is to make them into Avodin. But as far as the Isur of Knisa Lakal, of marrying into the faith, that was a Doraisa Isur regardless of David. Whereas according to Rashi, already in that generation, they could, on a Doraisa level, marry into the Kal. The Rabbanan, and that's the Gzeir of David, that made it us. Now the Mishnah tells us that even though you're not allowed to marry this woman, nevertheless, she still has rights to knas. And that would seem to indicate that they do have some status in halacha. So if you have a nesina, naira, besula, then the ma'anes would have to pay the knas, even though he cannot marry her. Now again, why can't he marry her? Because according to Rabbeinu Tam, because of Lo Tischatein Bam. According to Rashi, because of the gzeir of David HaMelech, that she has the status of a shivcha. But in any event, she has the same status here in the Mishnah as a mamzeres. That just like in the case of a ma'anis mamzeres, even though he's not allowed to marry her, nevertheless he pays the knas, the same principle applies to Nesina. Then we get to the third category, which is called kusis. Now, who are the kusim? Again, these were individuals who came to convert because they were afraid of the Jewish people. So Rashi points out in the Dibra Maskel Kusis, Kosavre means that the author of this mission maintains the position that Gere Arayoshem, that their Gerus was not a valid Gerus. Now the word Arayos means lions, because the lions would attack the people who instigated against the Jewish nation, again at that particular time in history. And about these people, since their gerus is not recognized because of the fact that they weren't motivated to join the Jewish people, is therefore yeshnon belav de lo tischatein bam. They are included under the lav of lo tischatein bam, that you're not allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman. So whereas Nesina, according to Rashi, is only Darabana based on Gzeres David, Kusis is a Gerus that's completely invalid, and therefore on a Doraisa level already, she's prohibited from marrying a Jewish man because of Lotus Chatein Bom. Next we get to the case of a Shvuya. Habaya al Gyores, Viala Shvuya, Viala Shivcha. Now all these three cases are cases of a woman who had a relationship with another man even before the Ma'anis came to be. And yet it's listed under the cases that Elu Narashi Yeshlam Knas. Now we said the Knas for Ma'anis only applies to a Besula. In these three cases, she's not a Besula. So how could it be that he pays Knas? So again, we're going to go through these three cases one by one to explain how we know that she already had a relationship. She's not a Besula. But the Mishnah says that in these three cases, she is not a Besula physically, maybe, but she is a Besula. How could I say that she's not a Besula and she had a relationship, but yet she is a Besula? So the answer is, if you want to underline these words, Pchusos mibnos shalashan v'yomech. That the gerus, or the shichrur, when she was freed from slavery, took place before she reached the age, the ripe old age of 3 and a day. Now we have a principle that Besulin Chozrin. Now, Besulin Chozrin, which we'll see these two words at the end of Rashi, Dibra Maskev Al Shvui, if you want to underline those words. Besulel Chozrin means that a girl who's less than 3 who has a relationship, her Besulin will return, they'll regenerate. But we have to overcome our biological explanation and get to a more conceptual explanation. What it means is that a woman who's less than 3, a girl who's less than 3, the Torah doesn't recognize that be'ila. That's not called a be'ila to undermine her status as a besula. So leaving out the biological explanation, because there is such a thing, for example, of a besula who doesn't have besulin, let's say she was born without besulin, she still has the status of a besula. Here's a case of a woman who had besulin and she lost them, but nevertheless they'll regenerate. But that's really not the point. The point is that the Torah doesn't recognize the bia as a bia. Alright, I'm oversimplifying something that's very, very complicated. So let's go through these three cases. One case is that of a gioris. A gioris is considered becheskas be'ula, meaning the assumption is that she had be'ula. We don't give her the benefit of a chazaka that she's a besula. Remember, we even mentioned it yesterday, that a woman is born a besula, and we assume she remains a besula until we know otherwise, until proven she's innocent, until proven guilty. That chazaka only applies to a bas Yisrael. It doesn't apply to a gioris. So the gioris is assumed to be a be'ula. That's why, for example, in a ksuba of a gioris, she'll get only mea, she won't get masayim. But in this case, she'll get masayim. She's still a besula. Why? Because at what age did she become a gioris? Under 3. Now, how could a woman become a gioris when she's less than 3? The principle, the fundamental principle of gerus is kabbalas ol mitzvos. How could a girl who's 2.9 years old accept mitzvahs? So this is a sugya on Daf Yud Aleph in the same Masechta. If you want to take a quick peek without losing the place, the Mishnah says, "Agiyoris v'ashvira shir sheniftu v'nishtach v'nishgai v'nishtachu v'chusos mivnos sholoshon v'echad ksubos on masai." So she gets the full ksuba of a besula, meaning 200 zuz. So this is a very interesting quiz question. How can you have a gioris that gets the ksuba of a besula of a sayim zuz when a gioris is becheskas be'ula? And the answer is because a gioris took place before she was 3 years old. Says Rav Huna, how could there be such an entity as gioris for a 3-year-old girl? She's less than 3. Gerkaton matbilin osal das bezdin. That line is a line that you could probably spend, you know, probably spend months on. And in my family, we have such a case. We have a member of that family that adopted not one but two non-Jewish children, and they subjected them to gerus when they were very young, almost at birth. And that's based on this statement of Rav Huna. Now Rashi tries to understand how does this gerus work, and he basically says that the bezdin becomes, Rashi says, you'll see it about eight lines down from the top, Heim Nasim Lo Av. They become like the father of this girl, and they can somehow vicariously accept gerus on her behalf. Very strange halacha. The Gemara actually says later on, Omar Rav Yosef Higdili Cholim Limchos, that when they become 13 years old, they have the right to reject the gerus. But assuming they don't reject the gerus, then the gerus is chal from the time that it took place. So therefore, in this case, she had gerus before she was three. She basically has the status of a besula. She has a chazaka that she never had a relationship before. And even though, again, she could have had a relationship before she was a gerus at the age of 2.9, but here we have a principle that's not called a bia as far as changing her status from that of besula to a ba'ula. And that's what Rashi says at the end here. He says, Shafilu nivola b'shivya b'suleh chozri. Now b'shivya is referring to the second case on this list. And that's the case of a shvuya, which is the tragic case of a girl, a Jewish girl who was captured by the goyim. And we assume in such a case that the goyim would have violated her. But again, she's a very young girl. And in that case, the pigeon, we were able to redeem her from captivity while she was still a very young girl. She maintains her status as a besula, because again, even in the worst case scenario that they violated her, but nevertheless, besula chozrin, it's not called a be'ila to make her into be'ula because she was less than 3 years old. And finally, the third case is the case of a shivcha. Now, gentlemen, do you know about a shivcha? A shivcha becomes a Jewish girl immediately upon shichrur, means when the master gives her a get shichrur, he gives her a document to be meshachar her, and she's freed from her status as a shivcha, as a slave. At that moment in time, she becomes a gioris. She becomes automatically a convert to Judaism. And as a result, since this took place before she was 3 years old, she converted before the age of three, and we said already that a girl who converts before the age of three is still a besul. Now, the most important subject of this entire chapter, let's see, how long is the chapter? It's about 10 blot long, am I right? Yeah, it's more than 10, wow. It's 13 blot. So if we learn this chapter, it's going to take us way into and beyond the summer months. Way, way beyond. Probably take us about 6 months. So the main issue of this entire chapter is coming up right now in the second part of the Mishnah. Okay, now let me make the following statement. The most important principle of this sugya, of this entire chapter in Shas, is called Kim Leib D'Rabba Mineh. Are you familiar with that? Kim Leib D'Rabba Mineh means that if a person violates a criminal act and it's a double header, meaning he should be punished for two different violations with that same action, then he only gets the more severe punishment and he's alleviated from the lesser punishment. And that's going to be the subject of the second part of this Mishnah. A man was ma'anis a woman in a way, in a situation where he's going to get a severe penalty, a physical punishment. And the question now is, does he pay the normal knas if she were a nara besula? So let's say, for example, the first case, Saba al achoso. Okay, a man rapes his own sister, and it's happened in Tanakh and beyond. and she is a girl who is 12 years old, up to 12 and a half, and she's never had a relationship before. So in such a case, insofar as she's a Naira Basula, he should have to pay, as a Ma'anis pays, Chamishim Kesef. But paradoxically, he's chayav for another violation, which is going to generate a very severe punishment, which he can't get away with just paying and redeeming with monetary compensation. Because Abal Achoso is chayav kares, and if there was Edom and Asra, he's going to be chayav malka, so he gets 39 lashes. Or another case is Achos Aviv. A man has a relationship with his aunt that's the sister of his father, or Achos Imo, his aunt from his mother, or Achos Ishto, which means his sister-in-law, or Ashes Achiv, which is another case of a sister-in-law. In other words, the wife of his brother after his brother dies. Now again, we're assuming his brother died and left children, because otherwise there's a mitzvah of Yibum. But let's assume there's no mitzvah of Yibum. That's called Ashes Achiv. And that's an Issa Karis. All this is read on Yom Kippur in Parshas Achrimos. Anyway, then we get the case of Al Eishes Achi Aviv. Okay, this is another aunt. This is the aunt because she was married to his uncle, the Al Anida, and he raped a woman who was a Nida. And a Nida is an Issa Karis, and for sure, if they were Edom and Asura, you get Malkus for that. And yet, paradoxically, the Mishnah says, Yeshlem Knas. There is Knas. He does have to pay the Chamishim Kesef. Afal Pishem Big Kores, even though he's Chayiv Kores. Now, in a Chayiv Kores, ain't by Mises Bezdin, it's not a capital crime. In other words, Eishes Ish is not listed on this in this list. What's common to all these lists of psulos is that they are all chiyuve kares, which means that there's no misa, there's no capital punishment. And the Mishnah says that if there's no capital punishment, then you have to pay the monetary penalty, the knas. Meaning the only time we're going to apply the principle of kimle v'derabimine is for someone who has violated a capital crime, he's chayav misas bezdin, and he doesn't have to pay damages. You know, shkoyach, like this is probably the last thing on his mind now at this point, right? But that's kimle v'derabimine. And this is a very problematic Mishnah, because the sugya in Masechet Makos assumes a different principle. Ein adam lokeh mishalim, that a person who gets 39 lashes doesn't have to pay damages. Here, the Mishnah is taking a whole different position. And that is that unless he violated a chi of Misa, Misa's Bezdin, he will pay damages, even though he's chai of Malkus. But if you take a look at Rashi, the last Rashi in the Mishnah, he writes, Afal Pishen Be Kores, etc., Kores lo potele mi tashlumen. Kores does not have the power to knock off the chiyuv tashlumin, the payment, the compensation of 50 kesef. What does Rashi omit? What does Rashi not say? Instead of the word kores, can you think of another word that Rashi could have substituted? You're in trouble because he gave me your Gemara. You see, that's the thing. I actually wanted to come a little early today and photocopy, but again, I didn't make it on time. Rashi could have said, Umalkus lo potale mina tashlumin. Rashi says, Kares lo potale mina tashlumin. It could be that according to Rashi, if in all these cases, in the safe of the Mishnah, there would be a chi of Malkus, meaning there was Edom and Asra, there were witnesses who gave him a warning, then El Chinami, he would not pay Chamishim Kesef because Kimle ben Ramine. And that would substantiate the principle of Ein Adam Lokeh Mishalim, that you can't give Malkus and then make a person pay. Rashi's saying that this is a case where there was no Edom Vasra, there was no Malkus. And what are we left with? What is the only punishment that's left if there was no Edom and Asra? Kares. Kares is what's called an Onesh Bidei Shamayim. It's a divine metaphysical punishment. And God will see to it that he dies prematurely for violating this Issur Kares in all the cases we mentioned. So Rashi's telling us that we don't apply the principle of Kimlev and the Rabbinay if Bezdin is not able to mete out punishment. If the punishment is Bidei Bezdin Shel Shamayim, Bezdin Shel Malah, Bidei Shamayim, then there's no Kimlev and the Rabbinay. So for example, I'm going to ask you a double quiz question. Let's say a man would burn down his friend's haystack on Shabbos. Does he pay for the haystack? Question number two, what if he burns down his friend's haystack on Yom Kippur? Does he pay compensation for the haystack? So what would be the difference between the two cases, Osher? In the first case of Shabbos, it's a chiyuv misas
bezdin. You have a chiyuv for it, therefore, completely the rabbanan, and he doesn't get anything. The second case is it should be a case of misa de shamayim, right?
Of karis, right?
Of karis, and therefore he would have to pay.
Excellent. So that's what I think Rashi is saying, that the list that the Mishnah mentions here is a list of Yom Kippur, so to speak, meaning it's all Achiv Karis. Even though Achiv Karis always has Malkis, but that's contingent upon Edom and Asra. So if there were no Edom and Asra, there were no witnesses, then all you're left with is the Chiv of Karis, which is Videh Shemayim, and that's not enough to knock off the punishment. So that's going to be the subject of this entire sugya over here. Kimlev and Rami. What are the parameters of Kimlev and Rami? When do we apply Kimlev and Rami? When do we not apply Kimlev and Rami? So let's take a look at the Gemara straight away. Hani naros psulos islei knas ksheros lo. The Mishnah says elu naros yeshlem knas, and it gives us a whole list of psulos. These are women that he's enjoined from marrying, like a mamzeres. So only a woman who's a mamzeres gets knas. So what about a kshera, a woman that he could marry? Lo, that's impossible. Hachi kamar. This is what the Mishnah says: Elu naros psulos sheyesh lem knas. It was simple. It was understood that if she's a kshera, she gets knas. The Mishnah wants to tell you a bigger chiddush, and that is that even though you cannot marry this woman because she's psula, she's a mamzeres, nevertheless you have to pay knas, as we discussed at great length. So therefore, the Mishnah wants to tell you that amongst the psulos, here's the list where she gets a knas. There'll be other psulos where she will not collect knas because of the principle of kimlei b'drabine. For example, if there was edim and asron in case of chiyuv kares, and you get malkis, or in a case of a chiyuv misas bezdin, in those cases, she will not collect knas. So now the Gemara asks the following: Nara in ktanolo. The Mishnah says that you only pay knas if you raped a nara, meaning she's 12, but not if she was a minor. She was less than 12. She's a ktana. Gemara says, Mantana, who is the author of this Mishnah who maintains that a ketana does not collect knas? Om Rabbi Yehuda Marav, Rabbi Meir. In other words, there's going to be a machlokis between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. And according to the Chachamim, even a ketana could collect knas. It's only Rabbi Meir who holds that a nara and only a nara collects knas, but not a ktano. Ktano mi bas yom echad ad shetovish de saros yesh lo mecher vi ein lo knas. In other words, there are two halachas here. One halach is called mecher. Mecher means what's called an omavriya. A father is allowed, he has the power to sell his daughter as an omavriya. She has the status of like an eved ivri, meaning she's a Jewish servant. And if she's a ketana, then the father has rights to sell her. However, ein lo knas. Now, according to Rabbi Meir, you can't have both at the same time. You can't say that yesh lo mecher and yesh lo knas. If yesh lo mecher means he can sell her, then it has to be that ein lo knas, that there is no knas. So when is the parsha of knas? When does it apply? Mishetovi shtei saros ad sheti boger, because yesh lo knas v'ein lo mecher. Once she becomes a nara, the father could not sell her as an omo. That's called ein lo mecher. But yet, at that point, yesh lo knas. Because again, according to Rabbi Meir's principle, there's a mutually exclusive situation. You can't have both knas and mecher. So if she has knas, she doesn't have mecher. If she has mecher, she doesn't have knas. As long as she's a ketana, she's subject to mecher, and therefore she doesn't have knas. Once she becomes a bogeres, there's knas, and therefore there's no mecher. Shahoyer Rabbi Meir, Omer, Rabbi Meir used to say, kol makom sheyesh mecher, whenever she's at the stage where she could be sold, ein knas, there's no knas. V'chol makom sheyesh knas, ein mecher. So it means that knas is imposed when a woman is mature, and she's already left, to some extent, the domain of her father. He can no longer sell her. At that point, since she's an independent agent, therefore the avera, the criminal act of having a rape situation, violating this woman, and she's a mature woman, that engenders a penalty of knas. What makes her a mature woman? The fact that she's a nara, says Rabbi Meir, she can no longer be sold by her father. If she's not an independent entity, so to speak, she's not an agent, it means that she's totally in the reshus of her father, she's a ketana, and her father could sell her as an oma, then she's not mature enough to make that violation such that it incurs a chiyuv knas. The Chachamim omer, the Chachamim reject this. They hold that there's an overlap between mecher and knas. Ketana mi bashol shonav yom echad ad sheti boger, from the age of 3 and a day until 12 and 6 months, yesh lo knas. And that means, what it means, yesh lo knas, even though she's a ketana, is knas in mecher lo? What does he mean to say that she has knas, and like Rabir says, it can't be that she has knas and the father could sell it lo? Ema, but rather we should say, here we turn to Chav Tesam in Beis, af knas b'mokom mecher. For sure, if she's a ketana, she's only 3 years and one day, there is mecher, a father could sell her as an oma. The chiddush of the Chachamim is that there's an overlap. Even during that period of her life where there is mecher, there still is knas. So that's what Rashi says on the top here of Daf Chav Tes Amud Beis, af knas b'mokom mecher, u'mishum knas nokat bas sholom, shavol mecher mi'bas yom echad v'yad shetovi shtei saros. Okay, this Rashi is a little bit more complicated. I'll just say it on a very superficial level. Rashi holds that the reason why the Chacham mentioned that she was 3 years old, when in truth we're talking about Mecher, and the father could sell her from the day she's born, we don't have to wait till her third birthday, is because of Knas. Knas only applies when the girl is 3 years old. Again, according to Rabbi Meir, the Knas only applies when she's 12 years old, she's a Nara. But since the Chachamim allow for an expansion of the parasha of Knas, and the payment of 50 applies even when she's a Ketana, here we have to add one stipulation. She's got to be Ru'uya Labia. In other words, the act of intercourse has to be recognized by the Torah, and that's only if she's 3 years old. So as far as Mecher is concerned, Rashi says that from the moment she's born, he could sell her as an Omivriya. But as far as Knas is concerned, if we have to delay, we have to wait until she's 3 years old, and she's a Bas Bia, she's subject to Bia. Let's just end by reading through the Rashi's back on Daf Chav Tes Amud Aleph. The Gemara says that the author of our Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, who says that there's no overlap between Mecher and Knas. And since the father could sell her when she's a Ketana, therefore, ipso facto, there's no Knas. That's Rabbi Meir. And therefore, when our Mishnah says, Elu Naros, Yesh Lem Knas, and the Gemara is Medayik, that it means Nara in Ketana Lo, the Ketana doesn't collect Knas, That reflects the shita of Rabbi Meir. The author of Mishnah would have to be Rabbi Meir. And by the way, that's a little bit odd, because generally speaking, in the machlokes between Rabbi Meir and Chacham, who do we paskin like? Like the Chacham, Yachin v'Rav Malach Kiravim. Yet we have another principle, Allah Kistam Mishnah. So I don't know how to reconcile this. This is going to be a subject of our study over here, that our Mishnah as a Stam Mishnah reflects the Shita of Rabbi Meir against the Chachamim. Nara in Ktana Lo. That can only be Rabbi Meir, who maintains that you can't have an overlap between Mecher, in the case of a Ktana, and Knas. Knas therefore has to be delayed until the moment in which she cannot be sold, which is the moment that she emerges as a Nara at 12 years old. And therefore, Elu Naris Yeshlam Knas. So there's only Knas after the period of Mecher terminates. And that's Rabbi Meir's Shita. And Rabbi Meir therefore holds a Ketana Yeshlam Mecher. Rashi says, Yeshlam via Ba. The father has in her Zechiah, rights, Lemokra, to sell Lishvachos as a Shivcha. Again, be careful. We're not talking about a classic Shivcha. A classic Shivcha is a Knanis, is a non-Jewish woman. Here we're talking about a father selling his Jewish daughter as an Omavriya. I'm a little bit perplexed as to why Rashi uses this ambiguous language, Shivchus. I would have used the language Amhus. The Eilo Knas, Habole Eino Chayev Knas. If somebody has a relation with her and she's still so young that the father could sell her as an Omavriya, then there is no Knas. Once she becomes a Nara, she's 12 years old, then she has Knas, V'ein lo Mecher. She's out of the Parsha of Mecher. So Rashi says to explain this halach of Rabbi Meir, we need to understand a Brisa that's quoted in Masechta Erechin. Very impressive Rashi. Not that Rashi needs to impress us, but Rashi tells us that if you want to understand Rabbi Meir here in Ksuvas Daf Chavtes, you have to learn a sugya in Erechin on Daf Chavtes. So two Chavteses. But what does it say in Erechin? Or Arachim, as some people pronounce it. Yachol Yimkar Adam Esbito Kishi Nara. I might think that a person, a father, has rights to sell his daughter when she's already a Nara, she's that mature, she's already 12 years old. Amrit, it can't be. Kal v'chomer, I have a kal v'chomer to disprove that possibility. Mechura kvar yotza, a woman who was an Omevriya and she was sold as a Ketana the very moment she hits her 12th birthday, Yom Echad, and she has Shnei Simonim, Shnei Saros, she goes free. Just like an Eved goes free after 6 years, if he's a male, a female goes free the moment she hits Naros. Is Achshav She'eda Mechura, if he hasn't sold her and she's a Nara, Eino Din Shaloti Macher. You know, it's Narus is Meshachrer, it frees an Oma, it removes the status of the Oma as an Oma. If that's what Narus is able to achieve, then it means that there's no such thing as a Nara who's an Oma Vriya. So how can he possibly sell her as an Oma? The Chachamim, on the other hand, hold that there's a separate din of Narus, that Narus is motzia midei shivcha, it's meshacher her. But it doesn't mean that a girl can't be an oma as a nara if her father sold her as a nara. Mibas sholosh shanim v'yom echad she ru'uya l'biya, and so forth. So Rabosai, here's where we'll stop. So today we did Elu Naris and Ksubis. Yesterday we did a little bit of Sanhedrin, the first Mishnah in Sanhedrin. And the Mitzvah tomorrow will have our third and last experiment, which will be Bav Metzia. So if you can get a hold of Bav Metzia, we'll take a look at the Mishnah of Shnayim Oksim Metalis. Okay then? And then we'll find, try the dust will settle, we'll take a vote, and then I'll decide.
Rabbi Meir's approach seems to be that what can the Nara or the father get in terms of a class? What it seems to lack is,
it's all about the rights of the father.
That's right. But it seems to lack the concern that the rapist goes free for someone under 12.
Yeah, because What the rapist is doing is he is, in a sense, violating the woman. Like she has. Please take this. It's yours.
Talking about a katana now. The kids are katana.
So Rabbi Meir alleviates him with the payment of knas. Why? Because if she's a katana, she's not an independent agent, so to speak. In other words, the violation is for someone. A girl who's already in the parsha Didi Mominus, you know,
the focus is
she's a basta.
What can she get out of it? A knas or a father? Right. But a katana, she doesn't get knas
because she's not like an independent, viable agent.
He's getting away free for having raped the girl.
Correct. In other words, we're looking from the perspective
that's
of the
right.
Isha, right?
So how do they rationalize?
I'll give you another question. What about a Bogeris? That's an interesting question.
Well, also,
in case of Bogeris, he gets away scot-free. So the Torah says that only a Nara, according to Rabbi Meir, only a Nara is that six-month period. That's when she's in the parish of Knas, and she can generate Knas. If she's too mature, or if she's too immature, then there's no knas. There's a coin to a mayor, everything depends upon her status as a nara.
She's only focused on what can they get.
And that's where the pasuk only mentions nara. Right? Where's the pasuk? I closed it, I shouldn't have closed it.
Chof Gimel, I think it was.
Yeah, Chof Beis, I think it was, right?
Chof Beis, the last pasuk.
Right? And doesn't it say nara over there? Let's see. Chof Beis. Let's just take a quick look at the. At the pasuk of Beis, yeah. Ki yimtza ish nara besula asher lo rasa uspasa v'shachav ima v'nimtza. The pasuk says nara. So Rebbeinu takes this literally. Nara v'lo bogeres, nara v'lo katan.
You're saying that the shem is on the Torah, not on Rebbeinu.
Yeah, right now it's on Torah. Why did the Torah limit this whole parsha of paying and marrying her to the case of a nara?
Sure.